Non-Human Radio is made by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the local seasonal and organic delights at Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farmstar features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts. And they have vegan, oh yes, as always, vegan and gluten-free offerings, as well as craft beer and eclectic wines. Farmstar Pizza is open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner with live music every Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday evening. They're located at in Chico at 2359 The Esplanade. You can also find Farmstar Pizza on Facebook and at farmstarpizza.com. And we're also made possible by the Cold Creek Inn in Mount Shasta. The Cold Creek Inn, with views of the surrounding snow-capped mountains, free high-speed Wi-Fi, and organic in-room coffee, is conveniently located in downtown Mount Shasta near the Siskiyou Ice Rink, only 10 miles from the Mount Shasta Ski Park. Offering rooms with single beds to family suites, sleeping eight, the Cold Creek Inn can be reached by calling 800-292-9421 and at coldcreekinn.com. This is KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Non-Human Radio. Welcome to the August 15th, 2018 episode of Non-Human Radio, where we talk animal rights and veganism, almost every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, and streaming online at kzfr.org. With me as usual is Danny Toms. We are both fresh from the great outdoors. Please, Danny, give our listeners a summary of what they'll be hearing in the next half hour or so.
Today, we'll be talking about feathers, a story that we've postponed a couple of times in the past. And since the American feather story is set in the past, we will also hear about the link between British suffragettes and vegetarianism back in the late 19th and early 20th century. We'll end with the cautionary tale of a Texas veterinarian who, for some reason, killed a cat with a bow and an arrow. Jeannie? What's next?
Thank you very much, Danny. As Danny mentioned, I thought we'd pick up on a story that we've had to drop a couple of times. I first planned it to air a few months ago. This was a follow-up story on the modern feather industry, where we talked about the cruel practice of live plucking of ducks and geese for comforters and coats and how there are options to avoid that. This news piece is an article from the March 2013 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, written by William Souter. And this is on the history of the feather trade in America. John James Audubon, the famed 19th century painter of birds, considered the snowy egret to be one of America's most beautiful species. The egret, he noted, was also abundant. He insisted that the birds were so plentiful in North America that no depredation, whether hunting, the encroachment of cities or farmlands, or any other act of man, could extinguish a species. How very quaint, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you're going to get to it here. It looks like that statement was sort of pre-1850, you know.
Yeah, when the human population was way lower.
And we didn't have industrialization and massive production of firearms and everything.
Yet, little more than half a century after Audubon's death in 1851, the last passenger pigeon, a species once numbering in the billions, was living out her last days in the Cincinnati Zoo. That was Martha, was her name. And that species was to be replaced shortly thereafter by what turned out to be the final handful of Carolina parakeets, also a species that died in captivity.
Every time you hear that, you go, parakeets? There are parakeets in Carolina?
And you go, zoos? I thought zoos were all about conservation and right. preservation of species. It didn't work then. And that there's precious little evidence to show that they will work really well now, given so much damage to the environment. Anyway, the snowy egret and its cousin, the great egret, which are both species we have here in the North State and in Butte County, were similarly imperiled by the late 1800s, when fashionable women began wearing hats adorned with feathers, wings, and even entire taxidermied birds. The egret's brilliant white plumage was in high demand among hat makers, especially the wisps of feathers that become more prominent during breeding season. And if you look carefully, you will see these on our local egrets. They are indeed wispy feathers that hang out from their tail and are very beautiful. The plume trade was and is a sordid business. Hunters killed and skinned the mature birds, leaving orphaned hatchlings to starve or to be eaten by crows. William Hornaday, who was then the director of the New York Zoological Society and was formerly chief taxidermist at the Smithsonian, wrote at the time that it was common for a rookery of several hundred birds to be attacked by the plume hunters and in two or three days be utterly destroyed. The main drivers of the plume trade were the millinery centers in New York and London. And here again, here we have to take a look at commerce and how the New World, North America, served as basically a natural resources rich area to be exploited for commerce and by other, by Europe.
Yep.
Hornaday, who described London as the mecca of the feather killers of the world, calculated that in a single 9-month period, the London market had consumed feathers from nearly 130,000 egrets. Egrets were not the only species under threat. In 1886, it was estimated 50 North American species were being slaughtered for their feathers. Egrets and other wading birds were being decimated until two crusading Boston socialites, Harriet Hemingway and her cousin Minna Hall, set off a revolt. Their boycott of the trade would culminate in the formation of the National Audubon Society, which we have to this day, and the passage of the Weeks-McLean Law, which was also known as the Migratory Bird Act, by Congress in March of 1913. The law, which was a landmark in American conservation history, outlawed market hunting and interstate transport of birds. We're very good at regulating commerce. We are less good at regulating the environment. Harriet Lawrence Hemingway was a passionate amateur naturalist and was known for setting out on birding expeditions wearing unthinkably unfashionable white sneakers for the time.
Ahead of their time.
In 1896, after Hemingway read an article describing the plume trade, she enlisted the help of her cousin, Minna Hall. The cousins consulted the Blue Book, Boston's social register, and launched a series of tea parties at which they urged their friends to stop wearing feathered hats. Minna Hall later recalled that they had sent out circulars asking the women to join a society for the protection of birds, especially the egret. Some women joined, and some who preferred to wear feathers would not join. Buoyed by their success, in which some 900 women, Bostonians, joined this upper crust boycott. I think it's interesting, right? This is these feathers were an upper class commodity,
right?
And it took the these kind ladies in the upper class to reach out to their own peers. Hemingway and Hall organized the Massachusetts Audubon Society from these 900 women, and subsequently Audubon societies formed in more than a dozen states, and collectively they would eventually be called the National Audubon Society. And that's a shout out to our local chapter, which is the Alticol Audubon Society, and they run our annual Snow Goose Festival here in Chico. In 1900, Congress passed the Lacey Act, which prohibited transport across state lines of birds taken in violation of state laws. But that law was poorly enforced at the time and did little to slow commerce in feathers. A watershed moment arrived in 1913 when the Weeks-McLean Law, sponsored by Massachusetts Representative John Weeks and Connecticut Senator George McLean, effectively ended the plume trade. In 1920, after a series of inconclusive court challenges to the Weeks-McLean law, the Supreme Court upheld a subsequent piece of legislation known as the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, writing for the majority, declared that the protection of birds was in the national interest. Without such measures, Justice Holmes declared, one could foresee a day when no birds would survive for any power, state or federal, to even regulate. And that was an article from the March 2013 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine by William Souter on the history of the feather trade. And I'll just say the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918 and the Lacey Act of 1900 remain powerful laws that are still used to protect wild animals from slaughter and trade. The Lacey Act in particular makes it unlawful to import, export, transport, or sell in interstate or foreign commerce any plant or animal in violation of the laws of the United States, or of a state, or of a Native American tribe, or of any foreign law that protects plants. And it's used quite often, actually, for woods, for teak and other woods that are rare and not native to North America. Kind of an interesting law.
And that it's covering not just export, but they were broad enough to think about importing these goods from other places. And so not just saying, well, we're solving our problem, but also actually reaching out and solving problems that are happening in other places.
Yeah, and I'll just say over the weekend, I just caught an episode of This American Life, which is excellent radio. And they did a whole episode on the feather trade in modern days for fly fishing.
Hmm.
It was fascinating. Evidently, there are mostly men making fly fishing lures out of feathers based on what are called recipes from late 19th century instruction books. So these recipes call for very exotic and very specific feathers from specific birds, which actually have no effect on the salmon that they're designed to catch. The salmon don't really care what the lure looks like, but it's just this odd adherence to and feeling an attachment to history by following these old, quote, recipes for how to make a lure.
Like probably modern hipster fishermen.
Could be. They didn't give a good sense of what the culture was, but it is mostly men. I don't know if it's older or not. The focus of the piece was fascinating. It was about a young man, like a 19-year-old, he was 19 years old when he discovered this whole hobby, who finagled his way into the equivalent of the Smithsonian in Britain and stole study skins that were over 150 years old, that originated from Alfred Wallace, who was one of the naturalists who figured out evolution and natural selection.
Wow.
He was a peer of Darwin. In fact, he sent his paper to Darwin to be reviewed. So, and here it is. We have this ancient fascination resulting in this modern devastation. It was a devastation to lose that many study skins of a certain era, of a certain date and location. Anyway, the fascination with feathers remains. Aside from all that, the feathers remain best on the bird, whether the bird is alive or, in the case of these study skins, a preserved specimen.
I mean, if you commoditize animal parts or plant parts or anything, and it comes through a supply chain, and it's just one guy ordering a product and somebody else doing the dirty work, like, bad things always happen, you know?
Yeah. So just a heads up, just in terms of the Lacey Act and importation of animal skins, the federal government has just, you may have seen this on your Facebook feed, the federal government, the U.S. government, has just issued more than 36 permits that allows hunters to import lion trophies from two African nations that they had killed in the years since 2016 when they obtained their permits to kill the animals. According to copies of applications received through a Freedom of Information Act from the group Friends of Animals, 33 Americans had been issued permits to import 38 lion trophies between 2016 and 2018. And guess what? At least half of those individuals have donated to Republican lawmakers or affiliated with the hunting lobby Safari Club International. Man.
So they're not coal miners.
They are rich hunters. These African safaris are not cheap. So, and also Donald Trump Jr. is currently visiting the Yukon for a hunting trip right now. So
it'd be a shame if there were any accidents on the trip.
You're listening to KCFR 90.1 FM. This is Non-Human Radio with Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms as your host. What's our next news story, Danny?
Our next story is from the website Atlas Obscura, which recently did a story on the British suffragette movement and vegetarianism. This article is by Anne Eubank and was posted on July 3rd, 2018. In 1918, certain British women, those who were aged 30 or older, owned property and were university graduates, won the right to vote and stand for Parliament in Britain. It was a victory of sorts, yet British suffragettes, some of whom had been imprisoned, force-fed, or fined while forcibly agitating for their rights, weren't satisfied. They wanted equal voting rights for all, not just the older and wealthy. Of course, sad to say, women of color were largely overlooked during the British women suffragette movement. Much has happened in many places. In any case, these women started campaigning once more. Their headquarters were centered at a London club with a vegetarian cafe owned and run by suffragettes. The Minerva Cafe, which opened in 1916 and was part of a larger facility of meeting rooms and lodging under the banner of the Women's Freedom League, is what it was called. Historian Lee Lenneman writes that a surprising number of British suffragettes were vegetarians and had been so even before campaigning for the vote. While fighting for the right to vote, many passionately argued against vivisection, wearing fur coats, the previously mentioned stuffed bird hats, and eating meat. That just kind of reminds me, too, you know, many people, there's many paths to veganism and vegetarianism, whatever, but some people going down that path then become much more liberal or aware in their other social justice aspects of their life because they begin to see the sort of the intersectionality of it all.
They learn and then they forget and then they learn again.
Yeah.
And then they forget again.
At this time here in 1916, home cooking was considered to be almost exclusively a female task. So some suffragettes thought that cooking the likes of beans and grains instead of meat would make it less time consuming. Others empathized with the subservient roles of animals in human society. One suffragette speaker quoted by Lenneman argued that feminism and vegetarianism were entwined so much so that if a woman was unable to help the movement outside the home, even cooking vegetarian food for her family was a step towards empowerment. The unnamed suffragette wrote that, quote, "Vegetarian aims directly, as we women aim, at the abolition of the unregenerate doctrine of physical force." So I think we often say, you know, I don't know, peace begins with your plate or violence starts on your plate, or there's a lot of ways to look at it. Many members of the Women's Freedom League had formerly belonged to the Women's Social and Political Union, but left due to disagreements with leadership and violent tactics such as arson. The Women's Social and Political Union went on to become one of the largest British suffragette organizations, gaining a membership of 4,000 soon after its founding in 1907. While the Women's Freedom League wasn't violent, it was militant. Led by vegetarian Charlotte Despard, members refused to pay taxes, citing lack of representation. In one particularly dramatic demonstration in 1908, Women's Freedom League members chained themselves to a grill in the House of Commons. The entire grill had to be removed to take the women out of the house. And I assume that's like a heating grill or a gate grill or something.
It's not a barbecue grill, that's for
sure. It's not a barbecue grill. Vegetarianism was part of the British suffragette movement from the very beginning. To celebrate when women first got the vote in 1918, the Women's Freedom League held a pescatarian dinner, which back then is, you know, vegetarian, I suppose. The French inflected menu included a shredded vegetable soup, fish with new potatoes, and as the piece de resistance, lentil cutlets with tomato sauce. So
that was fine vegetarian dining for the time, I would imagine.
Lentil cutlets don't sound good, but depending on how you make them, they're quite good. The Minerva Club became a hotbed for progressive and radical politics. Anarchists, communists, and campaigners for the vote for Indian women alike used the facilities, and many people ate at the cafe, which was generally considered a delightful place to have lunch. Their dishes were vegetarian and cooked without animal fat, and even the china was political. The cups and plates were emblazoned with either the Women's Freedom League shield, which read Votes for Women, or with a warlike bust of Minerva, shining in gold, green, and white. The plates sometimes displayed the WFL motto as well, which was Dare to be Free. The club was open to both men and women and served vegetarian fare for years. But by the late 1930s, the facilities and food were no longer quite up to snuff due to financing issues. The rumor has it that famed author E.M. Forster, author of A Room with a View, Howard's End, and A Passage to India, continued eating there. The club formally vacated their Holborn, London premises in 1959.
And that was a short article, long on women's suffragette history, a little less information about their vegetarianism, but it was there. You know, it wasn't, this is not an invisible, this is not a strictly modern, vegetarianism and veganism is not a strictly modern invention.
Yeah. You know, contrasting with many of the more modern vegan restaurants I go to in the fancier cities, you know, they're not about revolution. They're foodie. They're vegan food, but, you know, it's foofy, it's expensive, and it's not about literature. It's not meat is murder is not written on the plates.
Yes, that's true.
So it's kind of interesting, too, that, you know, what capitalism will do to us, I suppose.
You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio, co-hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Annie Toms. Our final story is a news piece from a campaign for justice by the Animal Defense Fund. This is about a veterinarian, Kristen Lindsay, who is a Texas veterinarian, who in 2015 shot and killed her neighbor's cat, Tiger, with a bow and arrow. Her action came to light when she posted a photo of herself on Facebook, grinning as she dangled the still impaled cat by the shaft of the arrow. And in the caption on Facebook, she bragged, "My first bow kill, LOL. The only good feral tomcat is one with an arrow through its," that was her language, "its head. Vet of the Year Award gladly accepted," end quote. And I'm not kidding, this arrogant veterinarian actually did post this on her Facebook feed at the time. You know, this is a veterinarian's attitude towards what she felt was an unowned cat, a feral cat. So not only is it just a raw expression of her opinion of the animals that she should have been treating, it's also an indictment against feral cats who have it really rough out there.
Definitely.
In a blog post before the killing, Kristen Lindsay wrote that her current interests include killing things or trying to kill things like animals, a full glass of whiskey, hangovers, etc., end quote. That Facebook post provoked international outrage, especially when it came out that the cat was actually an orange tabby named Tiger, and who belonged to Lindsay's neighbors but had gone missing. So in not even a feral cat, not that that justifies shooting any animal with a bow and arrow. Reaction to Lindsay's act was swift. Her employer, the Washington Animal Clinic of Texas, fired her. Her alma mater, Colorado State University College of Veterinary Medicine and Biomedical Sciences, decried the grotesque actions and comments displayed in Lindsay's post. And the Animal Legal Defense Fund was among the many groups that called for Lindsay to be prosecuted. Among other things, the Animal Legal Defense Fund filed a complaint with the Texas Board of Veterinary Medical Examiners, seeking to strip Lindsay of her veterinary license. The Austin County District Attorney of Texas declined to prosecute Lindsay, but the Texas Board of Veterinary Medical Examiners moved to revoke her license. After she rejected that revocation and challenged it, the matter proceeded to the Texas State Office of Administrative Hearings, where two administrative judges recommended Lindsay's license be suspended for 5 years. For the first year, she'd be barred from practicing. For the following 4 years, she'd be on probation and could practice veterinary medicine only under the supervision of another veterinarian. The Texas Board accepted these recommendations. Lindsay, however, appealed, but she lost. And in 2018, just this year, the Third Court of Appeals in Texas upheld the Veterinary Board's decision and ordered Lindsay to repay all costs related to the appeal. Lindsay is now, of course, appealing this revocation to the Texas Supreme Court, so I suspect that there will be another update when that makes its way there. I just thought this case was interesting because it highlights the need for animal abusers to be brought to justice, even if they fall under the guise of a veterinarian. And it emphasizes that stronger animal protection laws and stronger enforcement of those laws is necessary. It also speaks to the value of simply speaking up and making a big deal and not letting a Facebook post slide.
Yeah, I mean, in this instance and in many instances these days, you see abusers and racists and all other types of horrible people who are kind of so horrible they don't even know it. So they post their horrible things on Facebook and brag about it, and they're getting fired pretty quickly, you know. And on one hand, you don't want people to lose their livelihood, but people are not, you know, some types of people are not getting the message, and there can be some kind of change here. And this is interesting too, you know, is she appealing simply like probably because she can't pay all these legal bills and so she's hoping she wins? Who's going to hire her? Nobody, no veterinarian's going to hire her at this point.
So, I would hope not. I would hope not, even in the rough and ready state of
even in Texas. Right. So
yeah.
Just a tragedy for poor Tiger.
Yeah, but you know, Tiger's memory lives on, yep. and serving some good here.
All right. Well, now it's time for the Chico Animal Rights Calendar events. You guys didn't get it last week, so you'll get it today. Get ready, Jeannie. What do you got?
Thank you, Danny. We have some great vegan-friendly events to put on your calendar. And of course, if you need more info, please send me an email at chicovegan@gmail.com, or you can contact me through Non-Human Radio on Facebook. Tomorrow night, the Wooden Spoon Cooking Series is being held by the Paradise Seventh-day Adventist Church. That's tomorrow, Thursday, August 16th, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. The class will feature a number of dishes with samples and recipes and other giveaways. Please call the Paradise Seventh-day Adventist Church at 530-877-4454 to register. Also coming up this weekend, on Saturday, August 18th, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. all day, is the Sonoma County Veg Fest at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts in Santa Rosa, California. The Sonoma County Veg Fest is the North Bay's very popular celebration of compassionate, healthy, and environmentally responsible living. It will feature dozens of local and Bay Area vendors, three rooms of inspiring speakers, professional cooking demonstrations, lots of free samples, and a full schedule of activities for families. For more information and to buy tickets in advance, please go to www.soco, that's for Sonoma County, socovegfest.org. August 25th will be the Chico Vegan Potluck, hosted by Chico Vegan Meetup. That'll be Saturday, August 25th, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Chico Public Library. As always, the plant-based Chico group will be there if you are particularly whole foods and plant-based minded. You can find potluck details and the schedule for the rest of 2018 at chicovegan.com. We are planning another Chico Vegan Thanksgiving potluck, so stand by for the date and location on that. August 26th, Sunday, I give a shout out to the Chico Pride Community Brunch, hosted by Chico Pride with Chef Ann Leon of Leon Bistro on Sunday, August 26th, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 1 Mile in Bidwell Park. As part of Chico's annual Pride Weekend, the exquisite Leon Bistro presents an incredible free brunch for the whole community. There will be plenty of coffee, juice, and breakfast, including vegan and gluten-free options. The community brunch is open to folks of all ages, so come enjoy some fabulous food and great company in the shady grass, and with any luck, the smoke will remain at bay. August 30th will be the Plant-Based Chico monthly meeting, hosted by Plant-Based Chico. That's on Thursday, August 30th, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Chico Guild Hall on Nord Avenue. Plant-Based Chico will be meeting, as always, to share tips and tricks on how to be a happy, healthy, whole foods, plant-based vegan with no added salt, oil, or sugar. Yes, it is possible. Yes, it is delicious. And for more information, please check out the Plant-Based Chico Facebook group. And then, coming up the first week in September, the Veganic and Vegan Block at the Rise for Climate Jobs and Justice, hosted by Seed the Commons, will be holding a week-long number of activist actions. So join the Veganic for Climate contingent on September 8th as they march alongside thousands of people for the largest march in climate for climate in history. Rise for Climate, Jobs, and Justice. The march will be taking place prior to the Global Climate Action Summit, which will be later in September. As global warming threatens us, the good news is that we have practical solutions to reduce our carbon emissions and slow the pace of global warming for future generations. According to conservative estimates, animal agriculture is responsible for 14.5% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, and industrial agriculture on the whole is wreaking havoc on the planet, which is no surprise to you if you listen to this show on a regular basis. Unfortunately, agriculture is mostly absent from conversations on climate change. And where it is discussed, that conversation is dominated by proponents of false solutions, such as grass-fed beef and pasture-raised hens. It is urgent that we put agriculture on the table, and that is what this group, the Veganic and Vegan Bloc at Rise for Climate, Jobs, and Justice, will be doing. All right, and that is about it. If you have any, if you have an event to share, please send me an email at chicovegan@gmail.com. And we have one last piece of business to take care of, and that is the animal rights quote of the week. Take it away, Danny.
Our animal rights quote of the week is from Mahatma Gandhi, the great soul. It's the action, not the fruit of the action, that's important. You have to do the right thing. It may not be in your power, may not be in your time, that there'll be any fruit. But that doesn't mean you stop doing the right thing. You may never know what results come from your action, but if you do nothing, there will be no results. Non-Human Radio is made possible through the generous contribution.